This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Afternoon in a hot, steamy sendo. Do you hear me okay? Yeah? Okay. I don't know everybody's name, so my name is Shoho. Why don't we go around, everybody say the name?
Michael.
Okay.
Emily.
Julia.
Todd.
Roshi.
Carolyn.
Peter.
Judy.
Menzen.
Stephen.
Hogan.
Tokyo.
Karen.
Doug.
Welcome. And welcome to this memorial session. I hope later to go into what connects you to Koban. I was told that's like the theme for our days here. What's the Koban? I forgot, by the way, but everybody sees this. Jerry and John and Amanda, they're still there. Okay, sorry. Let's not forget you guys here. Okay. and so having Koban as a center, we have his memorial of 20 years, and we have a teacher, talking about a teacher, a spiritual teacher. And so just to make that distinction, just to say some general remarks about teacher-student relationship before we go into your and then my stories and interaction with Koban, which I think is kind of the requested theme of our of this talk as an inspiration and encouragement. Just like some general remarks about teacherness, because in the English language, teacher is unfortunately without a distinction. In Asia, there's a distinction between the worldly teacher, like a school teacher, or you know, your mentor, your coach, your therapist, and in and then the spiritual teacher. There's like there are two words for that in all the different languages. But in English, it's one, it's just teacher. And so we are easily conflating these. So the worldly teacher is somebody who's bestowing a skill to you. You know, you want to learn pottery, somebody teaches you pottery. You know, you all got to learn reading and writing in school. You know, you go to a therapist, he teaches you skills, your emotions and so forth. There's always some form of learning something that helps us navigate our life, our interactions with appearances and relationships, and it helps us, you know, become more skillful, become more open-hearted, you know, powerful, whatever skill set says. A spiritual teacher is actually, particularly in Buddhism, about undoing anything that has to do with this world. Like a spiritual teacher is actually more about pointing out the transcendent to you, or pointing out a higher power that's not from this world and telling you about this higher power. In Buddhism in particular, the spiritual teacher is about undoing self, undoing your ego clinging, or your any grasping to the samsara, because that was Shakyamuni Buddha's main insight, was to, you know, this grasping and clinging to this world is suffering, and in order to be free of suffering, you have to release, you have to let go from this world. So a spiritual teacher in Buddhism always circles around wanting to let go. So one could say a spiritual teacher is your personal assassin, you know, somebody who actually like how to let go of yourself in many ways. And there, now that we are talking about a teacher who has died, I feel the memorial session in Jikuchi was initially, for the last 20 years for sure, a most important part of the grieving process, because the Kubanchino Roshi, he died unexpectedly, he died unplanned, and he died in a violent way, actually. You know, he drowned. So it's a big shock, and it's a something to grapple with, and we had 20 years. to take it in, and I feel most of us probably did so. You know, most of us who witnessed him alive and his passing found ways to be with this. So I feel like now we're in kind of in a turning point of, well, how is this conversation about Kubo and Shinoroshi in this particular setting? What kind of quality of conversation are we going to have? You know, who are we talking about? We're talking about a person who has been gone for 20 years. We have stories about him. We have students' accounts. We can ask them, people who met him and spent time with him and learned from him. And we can talk to these people, but we always hear a story. Like somehow with deceased people, it's harder. We mostly just the stories, because there's no other way we can actually access what Kubo and who Kubo really is. And there's a danger. There are two dangers. I just want to name them for all of us, because it's good to know about our dangers. I don't see them here in Chikuchi, but you know, they're dangerous for us because we're humans. And we can go, especially around our spiritual teachers, we are very complicated beings. That's my story with Kubo too, and I'm going to get more into it. So one danger is on our side. So Kubo from his side cannot say anything anymore. We can use him as our projection of all of our stories, of our needs. He was like the most perfect person, you know, he did everything, he was so enlightened. You know, just having him in the room, we would all just get it. You know, it was just like, he's just like the platform for all our stories and our ideas of what the spiritual path would all be all about. And that's basically what the definition of a cult is. You know, the cult is a system of veneration and devotion towards a figure. You know, it's like a certain kind of putting somebody on a pedestal and like making something out of this person that, you know, this person might actually have a reaction to, but he can't say anything anymore. So it makes it tricky to talk about somebody who has been gone for so long, yeah. But then there's also danger for the person and the person after him. So, for example, so here's Buddhism. I'm talking Buddhism right now. There's a story about Maudgalayana. He's a disciple of Shakyamuni Buddha. And he was told to have had a lot of spiritual powers. And he died violently. He was killed by bandits. So there's many, many stories, and I think the story of his death has been used to teach something. This is a teaching story about his death. So the story is that he had this psychic power, and he went into the hell realms, because some people with psychic power, that's part of the Buddhist tradition, they can go into these different realms and see and interact with beings in the hell and hungry ghost realm. That's part of the Buddhist tradition, you know, thought realm. So he went there, and he met somebody who was just like in agony, like some kind of hot coal or whatever, hot lava or whatever, being poured over him in frequent like time sequences. And the guy was like, "What did you do that you were in this agony?" And he said, "Well, I'm a teacher, and I have told things that were not right. I had told wrong views." So I'm not sure if this was this person, but there's one story about the Buddha being inquired about a spiritual teacher who had told people that they just should behave like dogs and eat what dogs eat, and that would help some deliberation. True stories, somewhere in the Pali, right? Sutta. So maybe it was this person who like told people, "You just behave like dogs, it's going to help get you into Nirvana." Well, it wasn't quite the way, I guess, because here he was saying, "I'm in the hell because I told these people a wrong view, and now each time they go to my shrine and make offerings, I'm getting this big hot thing, like I'm in agony, I'm in pain because I contribute to deleting, like getting these people into wrong views." So I'm saying that's not a very cool one, God forbid, but I really say it about myself. Like I'm really very careful about wanting to be a teacher. In fact, wash your ears after this talk, please, you know, like one can very easily mislead, you know, with just say something and we see it right now. When we see it, it's so easy, put some energy into something, make a thing out of it. So, and it has consequences, and we are connected to our speech, they're connected to, you know, our actions, and they're all ripe and coming consequences. So there are consequences, and so for us to like walk around and say Kubernetes that, Kubernetes that, that has karmic consequence for us. So if you're coming around with stories about him that are no semi-true, or we want to make them to be true because they suit us, you know, there's a danger there. So like that. So Kubernetes as a person, really grateful to have been fortunate to have met him. And now I want to know what your guys' relationship is to this person. So you can raise your arm. Did you meet him in person? How many people met Kubernetes in person? And, okay. How many people met a student of his in person and are here because a student was so inspirational, beautiful? And then how many people are just read his writing and just related to his writing or anything like that? No, so it's mostly like personal relationship. Yeah, you? Yeah. Like, yeah, a little bit, yeah.
About the writing.
Yeah, writing, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was kind of inspirational to you. But you also met him in person, so helps you, yeah. So it's just like seeing which degree of the actual person we are here. So we're actually here as a group of people who have met Coben. So how's it for you? Sorry for guys. Did you met Coben in person? Or in Jerry, you met?
I didn't, yes.
No, you did not. Okay.
Yes, I did.
Jerry's raising his hand. Do you want to say something, or are you responding to the question, Jerry?
No, I just wanted to say I did, responding to the question.
Sorry.
Yes, that's all.
Where is this people?
It's top row somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Any comment from the audience on the screens about your relationship to Kubernetes?
What is overall to the organization, to Jikoji?
Jikoji. Thank you. Jikoji has a big function here. Yeah. And Jerry raised his arm for having maybe met Kuhn.
Yes, yes.
Yes. Thank you, Jerry. And Amanda, you know Jikoji, I know somebody who has been in Jikoji. Thank you. So I feel like there's like a certain sense of reverberation that, you know, this person had and his fear. And so like, just to say my story before I open up to questions and more sharings about Kubernetes and so forth. My story was that I met him in Europe way back when I was in resident in Purek. That's like one of the centers that Vanya founded. And Kuben came every year to teach there, two sessions, almost back to back. There was a week in between. And in fact, he always skipped for all the sessions the first day. And I understand why. The first day is the day when, you know, one settles in, one has to kind of, you know, come to terms with the rules, like having to wear a mask and all of this. You have to kind of come to settle with that, you know, come to terms. And then you're ready to listen to them teaching. So he was actually just, the first day, he just never came out of his room. And I hope he was fed. I think so. He had his own kitchen up there. So he came there, and I was just there. I didn't go to Purek in order to see him. I was just like heard about him beforehand. And I mostly heard of him through Vanya, who I did the session with. And I was very inspired by what I mostly liked around Vanya was actually the community. I really liked the community. My first Vahatsu session with Vanya Palmas was a session on Wilke poems. They pulled out every day Wilke poem and talked about it. And what I loved about that session was the community was just respond to him with his glow of like understanding. Like here saying, pulling out this mystical theme and all these people just like, there's nothing to say, but we totally understand. You know, it was just like silent communication that was going on in the room. It was just like, wow, that's awesome. I want to be part of this community. And that's why I signed up to receive the precepts. And they were supposed to be given by Kohun every year. Some group of people can receive them. And of course, it sounds like what I heard very early on, that his engagement field was pretty dynamic. So he, like, for example, was supposed to give the precepts, but the day the precepts were given, he put Vanya in the seat and actually received the precept from Vanya. So there was this kind of, you just never know what to expect kind of feel around him. And that kind of enthusiasm about the stories about him and that I heard, they kind of like put me actually off. I actually had an aversion to him when I first met, because I was like, well, it's just this exotic person who's coming in. And what does he have to do with me? What does he have to do with my life? It wasn't clear to me at all. And at the time, I was also pretty close-hearted. I had just a lot of emotional struggles. So somehow they seemed to have interested him even more. So my encounters with Kohun were that he was just all very excited to see me. I mean, here I was just, you know, stoked in somewhat of aversion or just at least reservedness. I mean, I was friendly, I followed everything, I wasn't like disruptive, but there was just a sense of, you know, I don't know who you are and I'm just here and you are here. And he was just always so delighted to see me. One encounter in particular was just like strange to me. But first of all, I want to still explain. Now I see that at that time I was just very attached to Pepe. She's like the organizer of the play. She was my spiritual mentor. I really loved her and I was very protective that he would come with all his dynamic and destroy that. Like, it's destroy my little sandcastle. That's kind of see in retrospect. And yet, of course, he was a teacher, so I wanted to learn spirituality. And at one point, I found myself, him kind of like being with him in his quarters, cooking. And he wanted to show me to cook something in Japanese, some kind of greens with some soy sauce or something. And I just remember, just I couldn't stand it. It was too intimate. It was just too close, too fast. And I ran out of the room and I ran down two flights of stairs and wanted to just get some other person to come within the room because I couldn't stand the intimacy. And I just remember being down there and there was nobody. And I just turned around and he came after me up the stairs with a pan still in the hands and be like, oh, you wanna cook? And I'm like, I guess so. It was just this moment of surrender of like, I can't escape this, you know. And it was this innocent cooking moment. It was nothing. It was just intimacy and it was too much. Yeah. And same the other time when I was sitting under a tree and I saw, just looked up, I was in a deep, dark spot. And I saw a person come up and I could not recognize who that was. I was just so in a dark veil. And I thought it was a drunk person because he was just like this, hello. And I was cool and I just couldn't recognize him. And he saw that I was just like down some ditch somewhere. And he just sat, it was like 15 feet apart, just sat down half to me, half to the scenery around us and just sat there. And I could join him or not. It was just this open door and I didn't because I couldn't. So it was just this kind of knowing that came from him that it was curious. It was curious to me that he would be so knowing or so observant or so responsive in a way that other people did not respond. And the same with, you know, Dokusan. So I would go and I'm like, okay, let's do my hiding doesn't work, let's go the offensive, you know. I'm going to Dokusan, I tell him everything. I just like, I put it all out, I'm telling him everything, you know, my whole woes, my whatever. And he would just be laughing at me and then correct my sass and posture, ultimately, and then say, come to America. And I was like, that has nothing to do with that. I just told him, you know, it was just, I went out and cried. I was just like, this is not working, you know, like my strategies are not working and I don't know what he's doing. So anyway, he asked me to come to America. His there was his third child was supposed to be born, and there was kind of this request, not from him directly, but through Bepi and Vanya, that I go at the time the child would be born. And his wife was suspicious, and we got suspicious, and then we were like, well, there was another young woman. She was open to any both either one of us to come, so the other woman went. And I was like, well, I didn't want to have anything to do with it because, you know, if the wife's suspicious, I don't want to get in trouble. So the next year came, in 2099, I was all over Europe trying to do lay practice. I wanted to, you know, bring the practice to the workplace, bring my practice to a life, big self-growing farmer. I was just at that time in Romania, but nothing worked out. All this strategies that of bringing life to the world didn't work out. So I was all the way in Romania on the coast, and I knew Coburn would have been in Europe at that time. And I was waking up on my sleeping bag on the coast of the Black Sea, and just being like really desperate, just being like, nothing works. I just am not finding happiness. It's not working, you know, like that. And I just gathered all my faith. I had a total faith at that moment of Coburn being there. I know he was there. So I sent out a prayer in this half sleep state of like, what should I do? But, you know, just he was the one person who actually had something to say about my life. I didn't follow through with it, but he seemed to know something. So he seemed to be the, and which was curious in retrospect, because I had these other teachers. I had Bepi that I was really attached to. Vanya was a great teacher. But they, like, I think Vanya would have been with Kate no matter what I do. Bepi is just like, you know, no, she just wanted me to be there and work with her. So Coburn was actually the one who had sticked his head out about telling me how I could live my life. And so I'm turning to him. I think that was kind of the thing. And so in this half sleep, I had this vision of him coming towards me and giving me a big hug, just this loving hug, and said, just stop. Just stop. And I woke up from this kind of semi-dream. I was like, I need to take priest ordination. I need to go to America to get training, because there's Tassajara and training, all of that's happening in America. It's not in Europe at that time. So that's what I did. 2000, I came over here. And while I was in Tassajara, I went to him and visited him in Santa Cruz. And so at that time, my aversion was gone. I was probably more in the, like, you know, what can I get from you situation. And I was really open to him at that time. I was the relationship changed, the shift changed. But it wasn't from his side, it was my side. And I think that's like a big story talking about teachers, really owning, and in our relationship with any teachers, what are we bringing to the table? Because that's where the response is coming from. And I feel like at the time when I was in visiting him in Santa Cruz, he didn't have any more things. He was like, fine, you know, he was showing me how to wear the ropes. He was, you know, asking me about my teachers. He was just, you know, you're in a good place. He didn't, there was nothing though I checked in with him about that, and there was nothing more that he, you know, recommended or asked me to do. So he had a certain trust, I think, at that time, that the path I was on was just okay. And I, in that way, you know, he came to Tassajara after I visited him in Santa Cruz, just shortly after. And it's another brief story I want to say, but ultimately, like, my relationship with him really, yeah, in this way, was so simple, you know. I mean, here I was able to tell it in 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you know, it's just a very simple story. And at the same time, it was formative, you know, it was really, and it was, it's very personal. So it was, it's, I'm not sure what I can communicate. I will, I'm, in a minute, I really want to hear from your stories. But I feel like the part of it is probably because it's, ultimately, there's nothing to get it's really our own workings or our own processes, our own opening that is the path, right? And of course, there's danger that you fall into, like, well, I don't need the teacher whatsoever. That's like one extreme to say, well, it's all inside, you know, right? I'm my own master kind of attitude. Or the other side of like, no, I need the teacher. I have to check him without everything because I really know what I need to do. So these are two extremes. And I feel like it's somewhere in the middle, somewhere between, you know, checking in, being there with them and seeing their responses. Also just trusting ourselves, learning to trust ourselves, because there's this inner, the wisdom that's not removed from us. It's our mind. Our wisdom is our mind. And that also is this last story I want to share before I open for our conversation here. So in Tassahara, he asked me to be his teacher, and we go to the dining room. It was a little complicated there because he got confused. But anyway, then it was work period. He got there, he was sitting in the dining room, and all the people, work period people, were around there. And we did the chant, and he was like, any questions, you know? And I'm not sure what he was thinking, but I don't think he said much. He just said, do you want to ask me anything? And people's like, well, where do you live right now? And like, how are your kids doing? And like, this kind of questions. And he responded. And then after 15 minutes or so, he's bye, stop, and left. And I followed him home. And then at home, going inside, the same because his daughter was with us. And he was laid on the back. I think he took off his wagasu. And then he laid back on the bed. And he just said, wrong questions. And I feel it was definitely like a missed opportunity for whoever was there, because it was the wrong question. And so, yeah, that's why, again, I feel it's so important to have this distinction between spiritual teacher and a worldly teacher, and also the importance of, you know, how much are we strategizing and how much are we really just opening and just letting unfoldment, which then can lead to a certain insight, an allowing, I feel. But it just stumbles. I feel like in the dynamic, and that's what I check with your experiences and your stories, or do you have to share about in response to what I just said? Because like, it is this, we keep falling into the extreme, either the extreme of being with a spiritual teacher trying to get something, or the extreme of like being with a teacher just being totally averse to what's going on, because we think it's out there. That's like mostly where the extremes come from, is like we have the idea it's somewhere. And it's not that it's not out there, but it's also not completely inside either. So it's these two extreme poles that are to be aware of in the teacher-student relationship. And so now I would love to hear your response of on stories, if you have a cool story you're welcome to say, or just a response to my starting off this conversation. And there are no wrong questions, you know that too. Yes.
Thank you. I've always been really interested in what it is. I've lately decided it's chemistry, and I don't really know, of course. What it is that we see in each other, and when we're seen, mm-hmm. and when we see each other. And that doesn't happen always. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen with everyone. What is that? Mm-hmm. And not that I want to know. Too vast, but I'm very interested in that arising, and it's mysterious to me and something I kind of bow to when it arises. And it's not you and me or you and me, it's between us, something else. It seems to me to be the strong suit of a teacher-student relationship.
Strong suit, what do you mean?
Strong suit, meaning the best hand that you can get in a game of poker. It's called strong suit. I don't play poker. Not like that. But it is this kind of wordless understanding that it's just there, and you can have it with a friend who's a teacher to you, or you can be that person to someone else. And the thing I have some concern about is how not to elevate that at the same time. Like, how not to make it something, I mean, it's mysterious and beautiful and wonderful and joyful and full of potential. But I feel it's scary, really scary. And, you know, it's like, I have resistance to taking on that hat, that robe. I'm going to do my best, but it's a little scary. There's only one bit way off of a pedestal. And I don't want to be up there. And I'm curious to know if you have any wisdom to offer.
Wait. Thank you. Was this somewhat audible to you guys? Yeah, okay. No, thank you, because a very complex question, of course, and there's not one answer. My response, there are two responses when you were speaking, and this is just trusting the inner space to, you know, what's coming up. That's just so. I feel ultimately it's good, this inner sense of where one is at on the path, and I feel like there are several degrees. So, for example, for us starting to teach, we mostly teach what has worked for us. That's like all we can share, honestly, anyway. And there is an easy way out. So, you know, just know you're not the end of the world, and it's fine to let somebody else go to somebody else. In fact, get us a second opinion. Have somebody else get a second opinion, and for you to seek a second opinion if you're with a teacher, because there's a whole sutra. It's called the Entry into the Realm of Reality. It's the end of the Avatamsaka Sutra, where Sudana, who asked the question about how Bodhisattva is to practice, he went to like 56 teachers until he was finally, and they might have gone on, I'd say, you know, but just for the art, maybe they just stopped with 56. you know, so there's a, and he learned from all of them, all Kalayana Mitras, they're kind of friends of the way. And the other response I have is that we are making this. Like it's like a lot that authority is given, right? They say authority is given. And sometimes authority comes in the moment. It doesn't, it's not like you said, chemistry, there's this chemistry aspect. But sometimes it's just the moment. And can a certain moment, like, let's say you're in the middle of Illinois and there's just one Zen teacher there, you know? Yeah, well, that's your moment, you know, just this person might be, you know, sloppy when they're, you know, offer incense and stumble and who knows what they're doing. But at that time, you know, you get their dharma. Just if that's who's in the room, you know, learn something, be open to learning something, and not just be like, no, this person's, my chemistry does not work. In a way, that's a form of devotion. The devotion is actually, can say it's a form of giving oneself, but you can also say it's a form of open-heartedness, and that open-heartedness is to the Dharma. Bottom line, it's not like in the four reliances that are in the taught in Buddhism. Rely on the Dharma teaching, not the teacher. You know, rely on the definite teaching and not the interpretive teaching. And rely on the nature of your mind and not the word. Ultimately, bottom line, the teaching on the nature of mind. And we can learn from anybody, really. Because it's again in our perception. Like, as a teacher, as a student, it is a process of really coming to terms that we make our world moment to moment. We just make it. And the way we make it is how we interpret what's happening. And in this interpretation process, to learn that we have, they're already just so old, you know, they're just like, how many lifetimes of, you know, liking chocolate ice cream, you know, and this time around, you just, you have to get it and you see it, you know, it's just like a certain momentum that's being built up. If, you know, if you don't believe in past and futures, watch yourself in this one lifetime. And we are creating ourselves and how we see other people. And I'm open to you because you remind me of somebody else, but I'm also close to you because you remind me of somebody else. And sometimes it could be just as simple as a smell and we don't even really cog it happen. So that's what you meant is chemistry. So yeah, in this way I feel there is the self-awareness of, you know, of how powerful our perception is, and then also the humility to be able to open the door to learning the Dharma. And it comes out of, I feel in many ways, devotion to Dharma cannot be taught. It's really something that arises in response to seeing how true the Dharma is. Like if you start meditation and you have listened to the teachings, and you keep meditating and sitting and listening and reflecting, and then the wisdom of realization arises. And that realization is out of that the devotion comes, because I want to also bring the word faith in here. Ultimately, I feel that faith is a very, very central in Buddhism, but it's hard for us to speak about it because we are burned from the Abrahamic tradition. Just to be really clear, in Buddhism, faith is not understood the way it has been interpreted or has been thrown around, particularly nowadays, where there's a certain, you know, anti-religious sentiment going on. Faith, the way it has been used and became a what do you say, like a demissive word, kind of, was in the sense of using faith of saying, oh, just reason doesn't apply, and then you work on faith. So it's something outside of reason, and that's where people feel like now in the age of reason, because science is so strong and people really rely on reason a lot, then faith is not a path to go anymore because you're a person of reason, and that's just there in polar opposite in this culture. They're used like that. In Buddhism, it's not like that. Faith actually is considered a faculty. It's a faculty, it's a power, just like your ears and your eyes, that sees goodness. Like, it's recognizing goodness. Like, it's a heart quality. Like, you see a good act and you know it. And you have faith. That's faith that's arising in goodness because you see the goodness that happens. A lot of people in this context say, you know, like, yeah, of course, if somebody doesn't have water, or to give them water. It's just, you know, we all love it and we easily agree on it. But we also can easily get distraught about it because in our culture, we just put ethics in front of everything. Buddhism, actually, the faith is a reason-based faith. It's based on doing a lot of philosophical training. You know, looking at one's mind, looking at objects, you know, analyzing them, both of them, object and mind, and through that gaining faith. Like faith is actually nurtured through reasoning. Mm-hmm. And then this faith is then a faculty that can get so strong that even in the middle of your own death process, you won't be dissuaded. You know, you can't just, there's a certain, you see goodness even though you're dying in the middle of your own death. You can see goodness. So, and that's what we're working on ultimately. Yeah. Any more responses or questions? Also on the screen.
I have one story that fits in with what you were saying earlier.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it was at a session, and somebody asked Coben, you know, he was answering everyone's questions, and somebody said, do you know everything? How do you know the answer to everybody's questions? And he was like, looked puzzled, you know, and he sat there and he thought, and he finally said, the answers are in the questions. You know, which fits in with what you were saying earlier about his, you know, just getting the reading from you about it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and that reminds me very much of a, he shows again what a Zen master Kogun is. There is this text called The Ceasing of Notion. It's like discovered in the Dungwang caves. And the whole text is all about the one Zen text, supposed to be Bodhidharma related. The one inside the gate and the one outside the gate. So the one inside the gate is just peaceful. The outside the gate, he's stirred by desires and questions. That's what you're saying. It's all these questions. So the one outside the gate wants to get inside. He perceives the gate and he wants to be there. So the whole text is just questions. So he's asking all these questions. And then the one inside the gate, he's responding. And he, most of the time, is like, I really, you know, this is your question, you know, I don't even see, you know, on my side, I don't see what you're talking about, almost. I didn't say that in the text, it's more, way more skillful, but it's like this sense of, the answer's in the question, because the question itself comes from a place of unease, of doubt, concerns, fabrications. And so the one inside the gate ultimately is seeing the fabrication. And yeah, and that's what I wanted to say. So the next stage of teacherness, the one who's teaching just their own experience, is kind of the beginning phase. The next phase would be just allowing. You might, you know, have a skillful response one time, you might have an unskillful response the next time. It's just kind of allowing kind of the dynamic to be more messy than the rational mind allows. It's kind of like you're going already a little bit outside of the rationality in your interactions. So it makes it a little more dynamic. But then you grow more and more and learn about your own mind. I mean, that's what ultimately a teacher, what we do here on the path on earth, grows us into a teacher, if you want to call yourself a teacher or not, is you know your own mind, so you know other people's mind. So the more you know your greed, hate, and delusion, you see it in others, and not in the distorted ego-clinging way where you're like, I didn't get it, you shouldn't get it, you know. Like, no, we're free of self. It's the self got replaced with compassion in a way. And that compassion is like, you know, come to America. You're like too stuck in your stories. You gotta get in some space from whatever gets you stuck, you know. And so it's kind of like being able to see what somebody else needs. It's not what I would have needed, but what you see somebody else needs, because you know where they're at. And that's like kind of this knowing the answer is knowing where somebody else is at. And that we get to naturally by looking at our own mind deeper and closer.
Yeah. So also good to hear your experience with Kogun and that feeling of intimacy was so great that you ran, because I recognize that in me when I, and not just in relation to a teacher, but just in general, when I notice something that is asking me to be 100% surrender and I give all of me to it, like this next moment. Yeah, it's kind of like Pamela was saying, a little bit scary, like, oh, I'm on the precipice, or I'm on the pedestal, and the only way is moving forward, and that wholeness that comes forward requires so much letting go of what I think is going to happen and my interpretations of what's about to happen, or like Kokyo said, like, oh, we have this thing, you know, we think we know it and we know it, but it isn't what we, this interpretation. I think I was really struggling with your Dharma talk around that, because I was trying to like know it from my brain, but it's not there. And I realized what Kobin was saying to me was more circular, less linear. Because when I first came to Jikoji, I had gone to Hobie's. I don't know if anyone remembers Hobie's, but it was like a restaurant that had weekend or breakfast gatherings for networking. Mm-hmm. And so I went there, and someone from Jikoji was there. I was in my early 20s, and we talked about meditation here and the practice here. And this was in the early 80s. And I remember raising my hand because I was really looking for something to focus on. That's why I asked. So, you know, this meditation practice at Jikoji helped me to know what to focus on. Mm-hmm. And then I came here, and I don't know if I ever learned that. Sorry. but when I did meet Kobin, I felt this faith that you talked about came from me, but he demonstrated ways, like I heard I was breastfeeding and his wife was breastfeeding. Matter of fact, she looked a lot like you. Mm-hmm. Now I see you. I'm like, what? So similar. But and same age maybe. And so she ran out of breast milk, and I was always of the ilk that I had to go get some formula, because my baby was dairy, didn't take to dairy, so I couldn't just put milk in the bottle. And so I always had to have some mixture that was special. And so Colvin was there, and the baby was crawling all over his wife and crawling all over him, and everything was fine. We're doing Dharma talk. It's so natural and normal. And then we're talking about faith and how that arises naturally. And so she ran out of breast milk, and she asked someone, could you go get me some of the soy milk in the kitchen just from a box? And I was absolutely blown away. And she put it in the bottle, and she gave the baby, her baby, the bottle, just regular, you know. And for me, it just was such a demonstration of faith. And this is, you know, first off, the baby knows where to get milk. That's faith right there. This is where it's all coming from. And the baby was so content. And then the other part was, you know, this faith in her own judgment that she can do something so, what was off my radar. And so this trust and faith was just a continuous demonstration in the presence of not only him, but his students. And here too at Jikoji, I see it in the Dharma talks, you know, which are constantly revealing to me how to trust what you know. Mm-hmm. So that was really important that you shared to me, because I don't want to be scared to know what I know.
You want to be scared?
I don't want to be scared to know what I know. And I need the Sangha to keep reminding me I'm not alone in that fear, but it's also something I can get over in time with support. Mm-hmm. Carry on.
Well, you don't want to make the knowing what you want to know a polar opposite to yourself. Like realization enlightenment, if you put it out there, it can be a trap, right? So I think the one, just a tiny little switch there would be wanting to have confidence that we can do it, you know, like it's that confidence of like, well, the Buddha reached enlightenment, Kobun and Kobun's wife were able to do these things that inspire you, you know, you can do it. Mm-hmm. But don't fix that what you, that it.
Yeah.
Wanting to know it, wanting to, you know, as soon as we like get into some kind of dualistic pattern, I feel then when we just like perpetuate mm-hmm. some kind of, you know, either poverty mentalities or just form of gaining gaining ideas, or there's just like, so any sense of dualistic setup, including, you know, the whole thing what you're talking about, teacher-student relationship, you know, like, I want to be like him and I'm not like him, or something like that. As much as that has there, because